It's February of 2009, and the show for today is Instant Reality.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
What a week it's been, the first week of February. Obama's been in there slinging away fast as he can, changing as many problems as he can, one bill after another. The truth has finally come forward, my friends. The stuff that we've been talking about on this show, the authors that we've been interviewing, have been found correct. The problem is those with the money have isolated themselves the furthest from the reality that they have created. The tar sands is laying off. We barely talked about the tar sands and the threat it was as an environmental disaster to the world. And now people up there are worrying about their jobs. The pipelines have been made. The bitumen is still being sold to China and other places in the world. And yes, it's still being exported to the States. Here is the golden opportunity to go into research and development as fast as we can with what oil and gas reserves we have left, no matter what state they are in, and grab the opportunity, Mr. Capitalist, grab the opportunity to create a green industry. For once, think about doing something that won't be unsustainable. Think about if you want to make profits, and that's all that motivates you is profits, think about making profits on something that will never cause environmental and health damage, that will never take away from the very existence of mankind, which is air, water, and food. You've genetically modified food so that you can make a profit. Unfortunately, those genetically modified food diets have caused so many health problems, it hasn't worked out. You cannot be trusted to monitor yourself. We do need government, or the state, as some people want to call it, to monitor what these manufacturers are producing. Because when it's all about greed and no consideration but bucks, everybody, including those chasing the big dollar, will be harmed by the results. Just to let you know, in case you missed it in the news, ExxonMobil made the highest gains of any corporation in history, as far as I am told. They made $45 billion profit in 1 year, while we have hundreds of thousands of people suddenly unemployed because they are in jobs related to oil and related to the oil product, fossil fuel industries, as well as those like plastic, anything being manufactured that comes originally from oil. It's happening all over the world. Many countries in the world have stood up to the banks getting handouts from their government, their tax dollars protecting banks that are going under, their tax dollars protecting corporations that have gouged their staff and abused people so that handfuls of people can make billions and billions of dollars of profit. What is the point if the sea levels rise? What is the point if your generations after you cannot survive? What is the point if there's not enough food to eat? What is the point if you can't breathe the air? So if you're one of those capitalist-minded people out there that listen to shows like this and try to tell me I'm wrong, think about yourself, because that's the only person you have been thinking about is yourself. Think about how you're going to eat when there's no soil left on the planet that is suitable for growing good, healthy food. Think about what you're going to drink when you've polluted all the water through the groundwater. How about the tankers that overturn, dumping liters and thousands of liters of oil into the water? The water cannot act as a carbon capture for coal. That is another thing to point out. There is no such thing as clean coal, President Obama. There is no such thing as clean coal. When they talk about oceans to get rid of the problem of the CO2 and capturing the dust, well, you know, if you talk to a few scientists and educators in universities right from this university at McMaster, you'll find out that warmer oceans cannot deal with cleaning up coal. It doesn't work the same. You're working on a theory that is not proven in the field. As David Suzuki found out himself and said on some previous shows, when he came out of university, he was full of stats and theories, but he wasn't on the ground running with those theories to find out how they would actually work in reality. And then he read Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. Now, that may be a generation or two ahead of most of my listeners, but I advise everybody, get yourself a copy of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring and then tune in to what's going on around you. We don't have as many birds as we used to have only 4 years ago. We don't have air that's breathable. Islands are becoming submerged by water, and this is just the start. Wait till summer comes. Remember those horrific thunderstorms with strong winds that came last summer to southern Ontario. That will be the same, if not more intense, because we've made the global climate warmer and we've made the water bodies warmer. Therefore, we have faster winds, more tremendous storms with more strength, the electricity. Wouldn't it be great if we could find a way to harness all that wasted energy from the amplified electricity from the rainstorms and the thunderstorms that we got last summer? Those humongous, booming, quick-paced thunderstorms. That's what we should put our money into. Find a way to capture that energy. We created it. And maybe it would have happened anyway, but it wouldn't have happened as quickly, and it wouldn't have been as intense. So hunker down, figure out how to go back to the earth, talk to a First Nations person, talk to an organic gardener.
Looks like our economy doesn't just need a tune-up, it needs a whole new engine. That's why I like this Repower America deal. New investments to create high-paying jobs and no more being suckered by the big oil and coal companies. 100% clean electricity to power our homes, our offices, and yeah, even our cars. It's time to take charge of our future. That's what America's all about, right? Repower America. It's time to get real.
Some people say the answer to our energy lies in the past. They want to burn more oil and more dirty coal. Problem is, it burns carbon, and it's killing God's green earth. The future's over here. Wind, sun, a new energy grid. Imagine plugging in your pickup truck and driving all over hell's half acres on clean energy made right here in America. The boys in Tehran might not like it, but in Tucson, it's going down pretty good about now. Repower America. It's time to get real.
Let's begin by reading from Global Research Canada, titled Canada's Financial Bailouts, A Whole New Round of Attack on the Working Class, written by Steve DeSilva. It's in the time of economic crisis that it becomes most apparent whom capitalism and the governments that manage it really works for. For the last 4 months, politicians and mainstream economists have incessantly uttered two lies to the people regarding the current economic crisis. One, that it was completely unpredictable, and two, that we should not worry because economic recovery is on the near horizon, perhaps in a quarter or two. But nothing could be further from the truth, and most of these experts know it. The truth is that this crisis was completely expected and that our society will not emerge from this crisis looking like what it did going into it. Anyone familiar with the economic forecasts of popular and independent economic institutes like monthlyreview.org or globalresearch.ca would have seen the current economic crisis coming years, if not decades, ago. The root of this crisis? Stagnation. The root of everything wrong with the economy today is inherent to capitalism. Capitalism must constantly expand because capital itself must constantly expand, i.e., it must be invested in the production of new commodities and the exploitation of more workers so as to attain a rate of profit as high as or more than the average. When capital is unable to find profitable outlets for investment, this is what is called stagnation, and stagnation from the perspective of capital equals crisis. It's important to recognize that this crisis is characterized by abundance of productive capacity, an inabundance of resources, human and otherwise. This is what distinguishes capitalism from every other mode of production that preceded it. Crisis means too much productive capacity, and too much capital in the context of too little profitable investment opportunities for the kings of the economy. Another way to understand stagnation is that the capitalists are unable to sell all that they can produce. In an economy where the means of production, like factories, banks, communications, transportations, etc., are collectively owned, the notion that abundance means crisis is an absurdity. When we begin to recognize that the current crisis is one of stagnation in the real economy, we begin to see whose crisis the current one really belongs to. To make short a very long story, suffice it to say that stagnation has been endemic to the economies of Western countries since the 1930s. What staved off the current crisis from surfacing for over 70 years now has been the opening up of massive areas for new investment, such as the military spending for World War II and heavy war after that, the mass consumption of automobiles and how that paved the way for suburbanization of Northern America, the creation of the welfare state, which led to massive expenditures in public infrastructure from the 1940s onward, thus providing another major outlet for capital, and then the period of neoliberalism from the 1970s onwards, where much of this public infrastructure was placed on the market for privatization. Massive consumerism made possible by the rise of household and consumer debt. And of course, we cannot forget the violent exploitation and plunder of the Third World, which worsens daily. The reason that the real wage and the wage of a worker receives once we factor in the eroding effect of inflation has itself stagnated over the last few decades is because of the need for capitalists to exploit more profits from workers. And from the 1970s onwards, with stagnation beginning to rear its ugly head once again, and capitalists finding it increasingly difficult to make a buck or a billion in the old way by exploiting labor, the ruling class began to come up with financial schemes to generate profits. There's a reason that the realm of production is referred to as the real economy. It's in the real economy where the most profits are generated. When a worker takes out a loan to cover his living expenses and when the bank seizes part of his income in the form of interest, no new profits have been created. Finance has only found a way to redistribute income in the economy, not a way to produce it. Since the 1970s, in order to hold back stagnation, capital has massively redirected its investments towards financial markets. The problem with financial markets is the speculative nature of the investment. What does this mean? Well, to put the simplest of terms, at the expense of somewhat glossing over some important qualifications, the problem with financial investments is how an investment is essentially betting on the future ability of that investment to pay off, be it the rise of a commodity's price or the ability of a debtor to pay off his debts. How fragile this system actually was revealed itself to all of us this past fall of 2008, pun intended, when America's largest financial institutions began to collapse, triggered by the subprime mortgage crisis. Americans began to go bankrupt at record levels when they found themselves unable to service the unrealistically high mortgages and consumer debts pushed down their throats by financiers eager to lend out money with interest rates being so low. Millions of Americans lost everything they owned, or what they thought they owned. The greatest lie circulated in the wake of the subprime mortgage crisis and the current depression it triggers was that this crisis was unforeseeable. This lie became the basis for the kings of capital screaming that the sky was falling and pleading with governments that they were too big to fail. What has followed in every first world country has been an orderly and well-managed unfolding of the crisis whereby government after government has come to the rescue of private banks and corporations while leaving regular people out in the cold. The Canadian government's response to the crisis, the U.S. government's bailouts of private capital over the last few months, which now runs into the trillions and what has been correctly identified as being the largest transfer of wealth in the world, at least generated a certain degree of public debate in the United States, even if to no avail. The Canadian government has followed suit with its own guarantees, loans, and bailouts to the big capitalists. And we in Canada haven't heard anywhere near as much public debate. Instead of honest debate about the economy, what Canadians got was a distracting political theater in November of 2008 when the two big pro-capitalist parties, the Liberals and the NDP, and a personal note on that, I don't agree that the NDP is a pro-capitalist party, were trying to take the reins of government from the third one, the Conservatives, the most shamelessly big pro-capitalist party of the three. While hundreds of thousands of full-time jobs were disappearing from the Canadian economy in 2008, 140,000 in November and December alone, and recently 290,000. With Ontario being hit the hardest, the government was bailing out the rich. In November of 2008, the Canadian government announced that it would guarantee $200 billion in loans for the banks and that it would buy, through the Canadian Mortgage and Housing Corporation, $75 billion in mortgage loans from Canadian banks. And then came the U.S. and the Canadian government's emergency loans to the big three automakers, totaling $17 billion in the United States and $4 billion in Canada. Well, some argue that these loans were necessary to prevent further job losses. The loans cannot address the fact that these workers are less and less able to purchase cars, especially in a time of recession. And also that what is needed is a massive public transportation investment, not propping up private industry, which has proved so environmentally destructive and unsustainable. Well, the Canadian government says that these measures, the guarantees, the loans, the bailouts, were necessary in order to inject liquidity into the economy and get banks lending again. What, in essence, happening is that the public is being made to take over debts from private corporations at a time when these debts are becoming insolvent, like becoming more likely to default. And so we see that we do not have and have not lived in a free market, at least not for the last century. Socializing these losses and privatizing the profits has become the modus operandi of monopoly capitalism in its current stage. Meanwhile, politicians, mainstream economists, and capitalists deny that they saw it coming. Of course they do. When the big capitalists were recklessly lending out money to people who would never be able to pay it back, it's not that they didn't see the collapse coming. Is that they knew that they would be able to use the collapse they engineered as a pretext for a new round of attacks on the working class. A sign for the massive job losses, in what other ways are regular people coming under attack? Well, in late October 2008, the Conservative Party announced cuts to the corporate tax rates from the then 22% to 15% by 2012. Which in the current fiscal year alone would amount to $10 billion more in the pockets of corporations. And let's not forget the $490 billion for the new military spending over the next 20 years, which the Conservatives announced in June of 2008. Military spending, now more than ever before, is being used as a way to prop up profits for the rich at a time when they are trying to protect their fortunes and control over the economy. According to a report published in January the 8th of 2009, the pension plans of Canadians are experiencing historic losses. With Canadian pension plans being invested in financial markets, these plans have experienced massive losses in their investments, ranging from 10% to 20%, depending on the particular pension fund. Well, the federal Conservative government assures Canadians that help is on the way with the January 27th budget and that Canadians should brace themselves for massive deficits not seen in decades. Nothing that the Canadian government has done so far suggests that this help is for regular Canadians. The $20 to $30 billion more in stimulus spending being promised by the Canadian government, we can be almost completely certain, is going to line the pockets of the already filthy rich. And all this money has to come from somewhere. In this moment of the greatest economic crisis since 1930s, regular Canadians need to start organizing themselves in the communities and in their workplaces to defend themselves against the ruling class's new round of attacks. Anything above and beyond merely defending what we currently have under the system is going to take a far broader struggle than the Canadian working class is prepared for. This is the struggle for a socialist society, While Canadians are clearly not ready for this struggle, subjectively or objectively, nothing less than a fully socialist alternative can resolve the contradictions of monopoly capitalism that we are currently experiencing. And those thoughts by Steve De Silva, published in Global Research Articles. The reason I read that is because I agree with most of them, not all of them. And as you can see, this was dated before the budget was read. Something to think about. Now I'm going to give you something else to think about. To give you an example of some of the differences that David De Silva was pointing out, here are a few clips about what Obama did this week.
Obama taking a hard line on CEO compensation. The president unveiled new measures Wednesday morning that will cap cash compensation for executives at firms that receive government assistance. Take a listen.
For top executives to award themselves these kinds of compensation packages in the midst of this economic crisis isn't just bad taste, it's bad strategy. And I will not tolerate it as president. We're going to be demanding some restraint in exchange for federal aid, so that when firms seek new federal dollars, we won't find them up to the same old tricks. Top executives at firms receiving extraordinary help from U.S. taxpayers will have their compensation capped at $500,000, a fraction of the salaries that have been reported recently.
The tough new rules would prohibit payments above that threshold in anything but company stock, and that stock would not be able to be redeemed until the government's investment has been repaid in full. Now, the rules will apply to companies that receive what President Obama is calling extraordinary aid from the government. Places like Citigroup, Bank of America, and AIG got that kind of aid last year. Keep in mind, the new rules will not be retroactive, so all the companies that got TARP money last year will not be affected by this new regulation. That is, unless they get more government aid down the road. And this news comes on the heels of a new report from the New York State Comptroller's Office, which showed securities firms had paid out more than $18 billion in bonuses in 2008. That's an average of $109,000 in bonuses per employee and more than double the national median household income. One argument against this plan, though, is it could make some firms less apt to apply for government aid in the future. Dozens of banks have turned down TARP money in recent months, citing possible restrictions on how they operate. What is certain, things are about to change in a big way on Wall Street.
This bill that has been approved by Congress expands SCHIP by roughly $35 billion over 5 years. That's to a total of approximately $60 billion. And I know you're wondering, well, how is this being paid for? Well, it's going to be financed with a 62-cent per pack increase in the federal tax on cigarettes. And heard from Representative Frank Pallone saying that today is a day of celebration. Quote, there can be no greater cause than protecting the well-being of our nation's children. President Obama is hailing this as a bipartisan effort because there were some Democrats voted against it, but there were some Republicans, a few of them, that voted for it. The Republicans who voted against the bill included Representative Jack Lindner. He's from Georgia, and he said, quote, this will go out of control, just like all other entitlement programs have, and our children will pay. He's doubtlessly talking about the addition to the federal deficit, which has got many people very worried. We see President Obama is entering the room. Let's just take a look there. We see Michelle Obama, the First Lady, entering the room. We also see Vice President Joe Biden there. Michelle Obama just shaking some hands. Here comes the President of the United States.
This is good. This is good. Today, with one of the first bills that I sign, reauthorizing the Children's Health Insurance Program, we fulfill one of the highest responsibilities that we have, to ensure the health and well-being of our nation's children. It's a responsibility that's only grown more urgent as our economic crisis deepens, as healthcare costs have exploded and millions of working families are unable to afford health insurance. Today in America, 8 million children are still uninsured. more than 45 million Americans altogether. And it's hard to overstate the toll this takes on families. The sleepless nights worrying about somebody getting hurt or praying that a sick child gets better on her own. The decisions that no parent should ever have to make. How long to put off that doctor's appointment, whether to fill that prescription, whether to let a child play outside, knowing that all it takes is one accident, one injury, to send your family into financial ruin. The families joining us today know these realities firsthand. When Gregory Sechrest from Martinsville, Virginia, lost his job back in August, his kids lost their health care. When he broke the news to his family, his 9-year-old son, where are you? That's you. I thought so. Handed over his piggy bank with $4 in it and told his father, "Daddy, if you need it, you take it." Now, this is not who we are. We're not a nation that leaves struggling families to fend for themselves, especially when they've done everything right. No child in America should be receiving his or her primary care in the emergency room in the middle of the night. No child should be falling behind at school because he can't hear the teacher or see the blackboard. I refuse to accept that millions of our children fail to reach their full potential because we fail to meet their basic needs. In a decent society, there are certain obligations that are not subject to trade-offs or negotiations, and health care for our children is one of those obligations. That is why we have passed this legislation. These legislators have passed this legislation on a bipartisan basis to continue coverage for 7 million children, cover an additional 4 million children in need, and finally lift the ban on states providing insurance to legal immigrant children if they choose to do so. Since it was created more than 10 years ago, the Children's Health Insurance Program has been a lifeline for millions of children whose parents work full-time and don't qualify for Medicaid, but through no fault of their own, don't have and can't afford private insurance. For millions of children who fall into that gap, CHIP has provided care when they're sick and preventive services to help them stay well. This legislation will allow us to continue and build on these successes. But, as I think everybody here will agree, this is only the first step. As the way I see it, providing coverage to 11 million children through CHIP is a down payment on my commitment to cover every single American. And it is just one component of a much broader effort to finally bring our health care system into the 21st century. That's why the Economic Recovery and Reinvestment Plan that's now before Congress is so important. And think about this. If Congress passes this recovery plan, in just 1 month, we will have done more to modernize our healthcare system than we've done in the past decade. We'll be on our way to computerizing all of America's medical records, which won't just eliminate inefficiencies, won't just save billions of dollars and create tens of thousands of jobs, but it will save lives by reducing deadly medical errors. We'll have made the single largest investment in prevention and wellness in history, tackling problems like smoking and obesity and helping people live longer, healthier lives. And we'll have extended health insurance for the unemployed so that workers who lose their jobs don't lose their health care too. Now, let me say this. In the past few days, I've heard criticisms of this plan that, frankly, echo the very same failed theories that helped lead us into this crisis in the first place. The notion that tax cuts alone will solve all our problems, that we can address this enormous crisis with half steps and piecemeal measures and tinkering around the edges, that we can ignore fundamental challenges like the high cost of health care and still expect our economy and our country to thrive. I reject these theories. And, by the way, so did the American people when they went to the polls in November and voted resoundingly for change. So I urge members of Congress to act without delay. No plan is perfect, and all of us together, Democrats and Republicans, should work to make it stronger. But let's not make perfect the enemy of the essential. Let's show people all over our country who are looking for leadership, who are desperate for leadership right now, that in difficult times, we're equal to the task. Let's give America's families the support they need to weather this crisis. In the end, that's all that people like the Seacrests are looking for. The chance to work hard and to have that hard work translate into a good life for their children. Now, I'm pleased to report that the Seacrest story had a happy ending. It turned out that Gregory's two sons were eligible for SCHIP, and they are now fully covered, much to his relief and his wife's relief. I think Gregory put it best when he said, "Kids, look at us and think that we will take care of them." Every parent here has that experience. You look at your children and you know that they're looking back at you and they're saying, "You're going to take care of me, aren't you?" That's our job, to keep them healthy and to keep them safe and to let them dream as big as their dreams will take. And that's what I think about when I tuck my own girls into bed each night. And that's what I want for every child, every family in this nation. That's why it's so important that Congress passes our recovery plan so we can get to work rebuilding America's healthcare system. It won't be easy. It won't happen all at once. But this bill that I'm about to sign, that wasn't easy either. It didn't happen all at once either. And yet, here it is, waiting for me to sign. The bill I signed today is a critical first step, so I want to thank all of the state and local officials, all the advocates and ordinary Americans across this great country who fought so hard to get it passed. I want to personally thank every single member of Congress who is here, a bipartisan group who worked tirelessly for so long that we could see this day. And I want you all to know that I am confident that if we work together, if we come together, we can finally achieve what generations of Americans have fought for and fulfill the promise of health care in our time. So thank you very much, everybody. Thank you. Let me begin by thanking the bipartisan group of U.S. governors who convened this meeting. Few challenges facing America and the world are more urgent than combating climate change. The science is beyond dispute, and the facts are clear. Sea levels are rising. Coastlines are shrinking. We've seen record drought, spreading famine, and storms that are growing stronger with each passing hurricane season. Climate change and our dependence on foreign oil, if left unaddressed, will continue to weaken our economy and threaten our national security. I know many of you are working to confront this challenge. In particular, I want to commend Governor Sebelius, Governor Doyle, Governor Crist, Governor Blagojevich, and your host, Governor Schwarzenegger. All of you have shown true leadership in the fight to combat global warming. And we've also seen a number of businesses doing their part by investing in clean energy technologies. But too often, Washington has failed to show the same kind of leadership. My presidency will mark a new chapter in America's leadership on climate change that will strengthen our security and create millions of new jobs in the process. That will start with a federal cap and trade system. We'll establish strong annual targets that set us on a course to reduce emissions to their 1990 levels by 2020 and reduce them an additional 80% by 2050. Further, we'll invest $15 billion each year to catalyze private sector efforts to build a clean energy future. We'll invest in solar power, wind power, and next-generation biofuels. We'll tap nuclear power while making sure it's safe, and we will develop clean coal technologies. This investment will not only help us reduce our dependence on foreign oil, making the United States more secure, and it will not only help us bring about a clean energy future, saving the planet, it will also help us transform our industries and steer our country out of this economic crisis by generating 5 million new green jobs that pay well and can't be outsourced. The truth is, the United States can't meet this challenge alone. Solving this problem will require all of us working together. I understand that your meeting is being attended by government officials from over a dozen countries, including the UK, Canada, Mexico, Brazil, and Chile, Poland, and Australia, India, and Indonesia. And I look forward to working with all nations to meet this challenge in the coming years. Let me also say a special word to the delegates from around the world who will gather at Poland next month. Your work is vital to the planet.
I've asked members of Congress who are attending the conference as observers to report back to me on what they learned there. And once I take office, you can be sure that the United States will once again engage vigorously in these negotiations and help lead the world toward a new era of global cooperation on climate change. Now's the time to confront this challenge once and for all. Delay is no longer an option. Denial is no longer an acceptable response. The stakes are too high. The consequences too serious. Stopping climate change won't be easy. It won't happen overnight. But I promise you this. When I am president, any governor who's willing to promote clean energy will have a partner in the White House. Any company that's willing to invest in clean energy will have an ally in Washington. And any nation that's willing to join the cause of combating climate change will have an ally in the United States of America. Thank you.
Mahatma Gandhi, one of the most inspirational leaders in the history of the world, said halfway through the last century that the most powerful force in global politics is what he calls satyagraha, which I'm told translates into my language roughly as truth force. The reason why you have been able to continue moving forward is because you understand the truth about the crisis that we face. One of those inspired by Mahatma Gandhi, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., once said in discussing human rights, "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere." In that very same way, we now face a crisis that makes it abundantly clear that increased CO2 emissions anywhere are a threat to the integrity of this planet's climate balance everywhere. As a result, the old divide between North and South, between developed countries and developing countries, is a divide that must become obsolete. We must link poverty reduction with the sharp reduction of CO2 emissions, including reduced emissions from deforestation, with reform of the Clean Development Mechanism and adequate funding for adaptation that is essential and must be financed, even though obviously mitigation and prevention are the primary tasks, because without them, adaptation would ultimately prove to be impossible. We hear a lot. We hear a lot also about capacity building, a phrase that is frequently used exclusively with respect to the developing countries. And indeed, capacity building is important there. But I want to talk about the need for capacity building in the developed countries as well. The political systems in the developed world have become sclerotic. We have to overcome the paralysis that has prevented us from acting and focus clearly and unblinkingly on this crisis, rather than on spending so much time on O.J. Simpson and Paris Hilton and Anna Nicole Smith. Our hopes for success and the doubts that constantly complicate this task. We have to call upon the people of the world to speak up more forcefully, to put their weight in the balance of the scales that are measured by world leaders. The truth is that the goals we are reaching toward are incredibly difficult. And even a goal of 450 parts per million, which seems so difficult today, is inadequate. We will soon need to toughen that goal to 350. in this process understand all too clearly the difference between stating the goal and reaching the goal. As governments come to grips with the very difficult work that has to be performed in order to reach even a goal of 450 parts per million, the task can seem very daunting. But for those of us who do understand that the goal should be tougher still, let us remember that the early steps in a process of reaching a goal of 450 parts per million and a process to reach 350 parts per million, the early steps are very similar. And we know from experience that once the process of change begins, once the momentum shifts, once the decisions are arrived at, then the task often becomes easier in the doing. As we start making these changes, we will see that they do strengthen our economies, they do create millions of new jobs, and they do improve the standard of living. To those who are fearful that it is too difficult to conclude this process with a new treaty by the deadline that has been established for 1 year from now in Copenhagen, I say it can be done. It must be done. Let's finish this process. This really is not a political issue. It is, of course, a moral issue and even a spiritual issue, however you understand that word. And our different traditions lead us to different ways of describing a spiritual challenge. But this one affects the survival of human civilization. It is simply put a question of right versus wrong. And we have to bring to bear that truth force and that moral courage necessary to do what is sometimes seen as impossible. Very simply put, it is wrong for this generation to destroy the habitability of our planet and ruin the prospects of every future generation. Must carry us forward. Our children have a right to hold us to a higher standard when the future of all human civilization is hanging in the balance. They deserve better than politicians who sit on their hands and do nothing to confront the greatest challenge humankind has ever faced. This crisis does offer us the chance to experience what few generations have had the privilege of experiencing, a generational mission, a compelling moral purpose, a shared cause, and the opportunity to put aside the pettiness and conflict of politics and narrower concerns to embrace a genuine moral generational mission. I believe that it is time, between now and the gathering in Copenhagen 1 year from now, for heads of state to become personally involved in meeting several times between Poznan and Copenhagen. I don't think that's the same. I am very optimistic about the leadership of the new Danish chair that will preside over the meeting in Copenhagen. And even though I do not have the opportunity to speak formally for the people of my country, I would like to relay to you a message that I heard from the people of the United States of America this year that I think is very relevant to the task the world is facing over this next year. Yes, we can.
that, of course, was Al Gore in Poznan. We haven't heard too much about that, but that was the most recent global meeting on climate change last December. People that are interested in doing something about poverty, they are having a coalition meeting. That's Tuesday, February the 17th. That's next week. Tuesday, February the 17th. The time is between 5 and 7 p.m. at the Research Capital. That's 199 Bay Street in Toronto, Suite 4500, Commerce Court West in Toronto. At the Tuesday meeting, they're going to try and meet some of the problems that have been recently doled out by the major layoffs. And we all know that ExxonMobil made $45 billion profit in 1 year. Well, 129,000 Canadian jobs are gone because of the related industries that they were working in. The passing of the federal budget has left many important recession-related issues inadequately addressed. So at Tuesday's Recession Relief Fund Coalition meeting, members will raise concerns about the following issues in particular. Homelessness Partnership Initiative funding needs to be increased and not just maintained. We need to ensure that monies promised in the budget actually flow. Employment insurance still needs to be expanded and made more accessible. Social assistance programs also need to be expanded and payments need to be increased. Now, something else that was mentioned earlier in one of my emails, the federal government has no control over the money that it hands out for certain programs. It's the province that decides on how that money's spent. So what you want to do is go after Dalton McGuinty and find out how they're going to divvy up whatever funds came out of the federal budget. It didn't do a lot about job creation. It completely missed the mark as far as green jobs. And I know that they're still funding the pipelines, even though the tar sands are laying people off jobs. So if you want to go to the Tuesday night meeting on the 17th, what they're going to try and cover is short, immediate term energies of Ontario so they can direct information to the provincial government. The coalition will be mobilizing around the scheduled June 23rd, September 10th releases of the federal budget status report. They are also collecting signatures to the Recession Relief Fund. There's a declaration. You can find it at http://socialplanningtoronto. That's all one word, socialplanningtoronto.org/recessionrelieffund. And if you didn't get all those details, I'm going to post it on my website. Hopefully by the time that you're hearing this show. So that's what's going on in Toronto. That's a coalition that's going to be all across Canada. They want input from everybody. What's going on in Hamilton? Well, if you are a temporary job worker or if you're looking for a temp work position, you might want to get some information, and there is going to be an information session held tomorrow night. That's Wednesday, February the 11th at the Sky Dragon. That's down on King William Street, right close to James Street, from 5 to 7 p.m. You will be able to get information about a temp job. And I've heard these sessions before. They're really informative, so you really should go. 5 to 7 p.m., food's going to be served. I don't know about bus tickets. I think there may be. But hey, if you get food from the Sky Dragon's kitchen, you're doing a good dinner for yourself. You can contact the Hamilton District Labor Council, 905-547-2944, or the Temp Workers' Rights Group at 905-522-1148, extension 302. And another site that I get a lot of information from now, which you sometimes see broadcasted on PBS, they have a story from David Corton, his past books, The Great Turning, From Empire to Earth Community, And his newest book, Agenda for a New Economy. Now, these are good books for these times, exactly for these times. You may recognize the title, When Corporations Ruled the World. When Corporations Ruled the World was one of the first books to articulate the destruction and oppressive nature of the global corporate economy, which we are now seeing up close and personal. That was 10 years ago. Now he shows the problem runs even deeper than corporate domination with a far greater consequence. The convergence of climate change, peak oil, and the financial instability inherent in an unbalanced global trading system. Now that would be the world trade, the free trade, NAFTA, all those things that I've been badgering about all these years. No such thing as free trade, and we're seeing that now. They'll bring an unraveling of the corporate-led global economy and a dramatic restructuring of every aspect of modern life. We are about to undergo the biggest change mankind has seen in thousands of years. We humans live by stories. We are held captive to the ways of empire by a cultural trance of our own creation, maintained by stories that deny the higher possibilities of our human nature. I want you to listen to some of what Dave Corton has to say. It's going to give you some hope for the future. And while I'm on the topic, if you have Jane Jacobs' Dark Age Ahead, you might want to put your hand to that book. Every time something changes, I am always amazed that Jane Jacobs predicted it in Dark Age Ahead.
Well, after spending 30 years of my life in third world development with the idea of we're going to end poverty in the world and coming to realize that somehow the general thrust of where we're headed as a species seems to be creating more poverty, more exclusion, as well as destroying the environment. And of course, and when corporations rule the world, I was focused specifically on the global economy, the financial markets, and the role of publicly traded corporations. It became clear that we were dealing with something much larger than simply, you know, 200 to 400 years of corporate rule. If we're going to get out of the current dilemmas that we're in, the path to self-destruction, quite literally, you know, it's not just changing the economy. It's about breaking out of these patterns, domination, exploitation that have been the defining frame of the human experience for a very long time. So, and it really is a choice between continuing on the established path of empire, of dominator relations, or choosing to bring forth a new human era grounded in the principles of the Earth Charter, which is about Earth community, reestablishing our connection with the Earth, with the living planet, as well as with one another, rebuilding community, rebuilding families, and making life our defining value rather than money.
It is time to tear down Wall Street and rebuild the financial system into something more just, more sustainable. So says David Corton, who is founder of the People-Centered Development Forum and chairman of Yes Magazine. He's the author of the book When Corporations Rule the World. His latest book is a kind of declaration of independence away from Wall Street. It is called Agenda for a New Economy. So the wisdom of the moment in Washington and in New York, given the great financial collapse, is tighten the rules, crack down, purge the malefactors. Not going far enough?
Not nearly far enough. What we need to face up to is that we have something that's actually even worse than the financial crisis. That we've had a failed economy for quite some time, and it's not just the financial side, it is the environmental destruction that we are, as a species, consuming way beyond what the planet will support. And of course, the Wall Street financial system drives the economy in a direction that pushes the most destructive forms of consumption, and all in order to make money for people who already have money.
An economist that you do respect a lot, the guy just won the Nobel Prize, Paul Krugman.
Yes.
He wants a stimulus so that we start really consuming again. He wants consumption now.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He doesn't want to defer this stuff or live frugally. He thinks we could end up in some sort of new Great Depression. You see it differently.
I've got a lot of respect for Paul Krugman. His politics are fabulous. But I'm afraid that that Paul, as with so many economists, really the environment is just simply not part of their perspective. But he still can't get away from the whole idea of growth and focus on what's really really beneficial to our well-being.
Well, now is your moment on this, because the ability to get credit to fuel prosperity in the United States has, to a large extent, dried up. And so we can't fuel our further growth that way. So you're inviting us to think about other ways. Mm-hmm. How do we get started on the reengineering that you think is necessary?
Well, first of all, you know, I think the answer is not try to fix Wall Street, and certainly not try to save Wall Street. Most of what Wall Street does serves no useful function in terms of the rest of society. It is about fueling financial bubbles. It's about speculation. It's about stripping corporate assets. It's about holding Main Street hostage to usurious interest rates. We need to let the failing institution, Wall Street institutions, fail. In terms of the banks, I mean, we do need finance in banks, but what we should be doing is not only buying equity in the failing banks, but literally taking them over the government.
Essentially nationalizing the banks.
Yeah.
It's happening in some other countries at the moment.
It is. But not necessarily managing them as nationalized banks, but rather, in a sense, go back to the way the banking system was structured when I was a kid, where we had community banks, we had community savings and loans that functioned as local financial institutions, where you can't insure an asset you don't own. I mean, this is all part of the games.
Politically, as you're trying to revolutionize the system here, politically, the ascension of the 44th president in recent days has been a very significant shift. But I'm not hearing the incoming Obama administration going nearly as far as you're discussing here. And from your perspective, is it going to ever get more progressive than this bunch?
Obama could not be putting forward the kind of proposals I'm talking about now, because there's been virtually no discussion of this depth in the public. So there's no preparation for it. People would be panicked, and of course he'd be shot down by the Wall Street economists.
And his financial team is drawn from the Wall Street establishment.
It's drawn from that group, where people put their savings and other people take out their loans to run their businesses and buy their homes and so forth.
Now you share with us in the book a list of things that have to change. One of them is you want to ban speculation as you see it. These are these, what you would see as crazy financial bets, some of which have blown up in people's faces.
There are a number of things. I mean, some very obvious rules, like you can't sell assets you don't own. Big change happens. It has to start with a public conversation. And that is quite literally why I wrote this book, that we need to get out there into the conversation, the idea that there may be deeper changes needed. And yet the extraordinary thing is, as I talk to people about this book and the basic message, I have gotten literally no pushback. It's all, wow, how do we make it happen? Where do I sign up? Because people are really, really unhappy with Wall Street, and it is exposed just how corrupt it is. And I'm very clear that if anybody had come out with a book like this a year ago, they would have been laughed off the street.
But David, people embracing this, have they really fully considered the austerity part of this?
If you get a group of people together in a little conversation about what really brings them satisfaction in life, it's not a lot of stuff. Now, you know, we need to be designing an economy that provides us with the basis of physical security. But so much of what we consume is simply, in a sense, to distract us from the sense of alienation and isolation, because we don't live in a community. I mean, it's extraordinary how the very structure of our economy has been literally destroying our families and destroying our communities.
The new book is called Agenda for a New Economy: Why Wall Street Can't Be Fixed and How to Replace It.
Curious about plastic water bottles? Wondering what chemicals are in our water? Well, here's your chance to attend a water symposium. The 44th Central Canadian Symposium on Water Quality will be held at the Canadian Centre for Inland Waters, February the 23rd and 24th. Contact Naomi at the Canadian Association on Water Quality, 905-336-4678. That's 905-336-4678. Or go to the webpage www.cawq.ca/en/44c. Bisphenol A, BPA, is a high-volume production chemical used to make polycarbonate plastic containers, such as water bottles and containers used to heat and store food, beverages, and to make epoxy resins that line metal cans. Other applications range from cell phones, computers, dental fillings, car parts, CDs, and thermal inks used to print receipts. Canada was the first nation to ban the use of polycarbonate plastic baby bottles due to safety concerns.
Redefining Radio.
CFMU.